Hi, James.
Hi, Will.
How you doing today?
Doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine. I'd say fine.
How's our nation's midsection?
Our nation's midsection? Yeah, I live in the America's six-pack or something like that. Iowa is good.
At the navel of America's six-pack.
Yeah, at the, you know, the pack 3 and 4 in the six-pack is approximately where I am, if America were an abdomen. It's great. Iowa's great. It's a lovely fall, and the writers are all in their garrets scribbling away at their novels and memoirs. How are things in Washington, D.C.?
Fall arrived like a ton of bricks, and so one day it was, green leaves and sweat and cicadas, and the next minute it was dead leaves in the dirty ground and the doggy dip at the local pool. On the last day, when the pool was open, they turned everyone's dogs loose on it, and so that was fun. But now the fun is over, and the pool's been sealed up, and we battened down the hatches until it's nice and sunny and warm again, said the California boy.
Hmm. You know what? They call that the doggy paddle here in Iowa City, and I missed it. Very disappointed. I just forgot about the day, and I missed the doggy paddle.
It's so Americana in almost every way I could think of, just sitting up on my balcony because I have no dog, watching them frolic.
Yeah. It's strange. Well, let's move on to more important topics than swimming canines. How about Roman Polanski, James?
Oh, Roman.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Good guy? Bad guy?
What do
all
I
of the above?
What do I think? I think he's a criminal.
Yes.
I think he's an Oscar award-winning filmmaker. I think
yes.
He's Polish.
That seems to also be true.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, I think that you've pretty much covered the bases. I think that the people are right who say that it's possible for him to both be a sort of vile human being and a person who's fallen afoul of some mangled due process questions
mm-hmm.
that you should probably care about too.
Yeah. So what are I haven't followed the debate about the fate of Polanski very very closely, but I've seen things being twittered back and forth. So what are the due process concerns?
Well, the concerns, at least as I understand them, are, not only is this a sort of 31-year-old issue, but there may not have been a charge against him pertaining to what it is that he's now being held for.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously that raises some questions. Of course, as soon as you turn this event over to public opinion, things get a little crazy. And you have Europeans saying this is an American witch hunt, and they don't understand the value of art. And you have Woody Allen coming out and saying, don't abuse Roman. This is an outrage. And Woody's people probably should have been contacted by Roman's people at some point before that happened. Damning him with that kind of praise isn't going to
mm-hmm.
help his case. And then you have people on the other side who say, Roman Polanski is such a horrible person that we should just sweep these due process questions aside. And although, I suppose there is this question of push coming to shove, are you going to be the one to say that seeing the sort of morally right outcome here is less important than seeing due process be observed? I don't know.
Hmm. I happen to be a stickler for procedure. So I hope they're following all of the necessary procedural guidelines. I still kind of don't. I've seen people making the it was a long time ago, and he's a great artist, so forget about it argument. Whatever sort of procedural questions there are aside, that just strikes me as silly. Just from I'm just like, well, yeah, I mean, I don't see what being an artist has to do with whether or not you raped a child. Like, you can be both a child rapist and an artist. The question of whether, like, he should go, you know, to be criminally sanctioned for his child rape, well, I guess that's just a matter of what the law is.
In a way, I think the real interesting cut here is, for some people, the real outrage here seems to be the fact of the rape. And for others, the outrage seems to be the fact that it's a statutory rape. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yes, rape is a horrible thing, but, you know, my God, man, she's 15 years old, versus age being less of the issue than the fact of the rape being the issue.
But wasn't she 13 and he drugged her?
She was 13 and not the 15-year-old was Natasha Kinski, right? The 13-year-old is this question. So yes, yeah. Very underage and drugged her. It's a bad combination, but it does bring to mind, at least to me, it sort of underscores the strange way in which we draw this legal line between youthhood and adulthood, and we say people on the side of, you know, on the legal side of youth are sacred, and people, you know, once you cross that line, then you know, in a way all bets are off, right?
Yeah, well, that is interesting. I did see you know, reports or people were citing, you know, his biography or something like that, which tells tale of his sort of tramping around Europe and sleeping around with you know, teenagers after he fled U.S. jurisdiction. You know, but so do you feel the same way about Natasha Kinski then? Is the, you know, is part of the question. How about 15 and not drugged? How about 16? How about 17? And I think that's a good question and a hard question. And I think, and I personally find the zeal with which many, you know, statutory rape cases are pursued to be, you know, just completely idiotic and immoral. I mean, a lot of times it's, you know, like the 20-year-old guy and his 17-year-old girlfriend or something like that, and the rest of that guy's life he's a sex offender and has to register in the neighborhood that he lives in. Can't live within, you know, so many feet of a school. It's just that, you know, that kind of thing is ridiculous.
Well, right, and then the sort of the raft of unofficial punishments that come along with the official ones and make it impossible to reintegrate in any way back into society.
Yeah, but I don't think the Polanski case is much like that. You know, I think 13 is pretty safely on just about everybody's side of the line for sexual consent.
Well, it doesn't help that he's so much older either.
No, I think that has a lot to do with...
we reserve a special animus for those old guys who can't just wait for X amount of years and have to ruin it for everyone. Although it's odd, though, I think, at the same time, that we revel in our sexually free culture and then revel all the more when the people who are kind of driven to do horrible things as a result of that kind of sexual tension, perhaps, get busted on national television, right? So, you know, To Catch a Predator and shows of that ilk where the old flabby guy is running across his lawn, oh no, and they tackle him to the ground, and, you know, maybe he's looking at pictures of 13-year-old girls, but maybe he's, you know, maybe he's an inch or two on the wrong side of the legal line. Mm-hmm. Which again starts seeming more arbitrary than maybe we would want it to be, but it's not clear what we're willing to do to come up with an alternative.
Yeah, I find questions about line drawing and these sorts of things pretty difficult. Like, I don't have a principled way of saying what's going to count as permissible child pornography. You can't take pictures of naked children. Can you draw pictures of naked children and use them as an aid to your, you know, self-satisfaction? Or can you write little short stories about the sexual exploits of children? Does that count? You know, like I incline toward this sort of the First Amendment kind of absolutist position on those questions. If it's just a figment of imagination, and there's no one is actually the subject of some possibly criminal event, like photographing a child in the nude for sexual purposes, when that child is in no position to understand what they're doing.
What do you make of the recent Supreme Court case that ruled, to my recollection, that even artificial drawings of what appear to be underage children that are produced at such a level of technical expertise that they, for all intents and purposes, appear to be identical to photographs, would be protected? Does that seem to cross an imperceptible or perceptible line to you?
The judgment was that those would be protected as, permissible. That's I would err on that side of it. The difficult question is if you make some photorealistic drawing or painting by working off of an actual photo and then throwing the photo away, there's still that photo. There is still the act of photographing that occurred that is going to be the wrongdoing, and this thing is just a little bit further down the causal chain. But if it's something that simply is done from memory, or is just an elaboration on perfectly legitimate things that you can already pictures that you might already have access to that don't show anything obscene, then I have a hard time saying that is, that really is crossing into sort of like thought crime territory. You shouldn't have been thinking about this at all, and now we've got evidence that you thought about it, and you're going to jail.
Well, but you can think about it all you want, right? There's a difference between cooking up an elaborate underage orgy fantasy and then creating a photorealistic mural of that kind of event, right?
Mm-hmm.
The harm is supposed to be there's supposed to be more of a harm than the harm to whoever you might find to photograph for that kind of event. The idea is that actually by producing these images that are expressly feature underage participants, then that in and of itself constitutes a harm.
Yeah, that brings up the old debate about pornography in general, whether it's a substitute or whether it somehow reinforces certain kinds of desires or both. If beating off to drawings of naked kids keeps you from actually being motivated to go out and find a kid to beat off to, then probably we ought to encourage drawings as opposed to the alternative. I don't know what I don't know how people are. I don't know what the psychology of it is.
And I mean, this is an argument that libertarians make more often than I'd prefer, because for starters, I'm not sure if there's any way that you can actually test that hypothesis, right? Or get the kind of data or results that would lead you to be able to make to come to a conclusion that would be reliable in any way that you could be confident about.
Right, but I tend to, my default assumption is if no victim, no crime. Like if you can't, and if your argument is that there's something about the a work of art or a work of literature that encourages a cast of mind that then tends to help motivate some kind of obscene or criminal behavior, I think that's just too much. I mean, that just seems incredibly ad hoc.
The argument for censorship isn't necessarily a consequentialist one, at least on this point, right?
Mm-hmm. Isn't necessarily a consequentialist one. If it is a consequentialist one, then of course I think the burden is on the pro-censorship side to actually show that this kind of thing contributes to a general climate of whatever the thing that is they're worried about. If you can't show it, then you have to assume that since there's no victim, there's no crime. If it's non-consequentialist, and you shouldn't be thinking these thoughts, or you shouldn't be drawing these pictures, it's hard to know what to say. I mean, it's just people are going to disagree, and I don't see how you adjudicate that disagreement.
Well, you sort of kick it down to communities and let them figure it out as they will. I mean, I think the internet is changing things in such a way that, from one angle, the old style of local obscenity laws is being mocked. But at the same time, I think it's also allowing people to set public standards that then they can violate more freely and effectively in private.
I'm sorry that local standards I missed what you were saying. What can you just repeat?
That from one perspective, if the internet makes it makes old style obscenity laws seem more ridiculous, mm-hmm. insofar as everyone can just go home and violate them.
Yeah.
At the same time, there seems to me to be it seems to me that that's in a way a feature, not a bug,
mm-hmm.
right? That we can keep. We can keep images that our freely associated communities deems to be obscene out of public view as best as we can, and then understand that the internet is a place that can't be and probably shouldn't be mm-hmm. as strictly or tightly regulated as the public square.
Yeah, well, I don't think I disagree with that. But let's try to skip on to our next topic, which is closely related, which is the question of kind of human dignity and what these boundaries are. So what's the old saying about obscenity? I know it when I see it.
Right.
And a lot of times when people are setting these setting standards for what's going to count as obscenity or what's going to count as behavior that crosses some kind of inarticulable line is that, well, that's disgusting, or that's repugnant, or that's sort of contrary to human dignity. And that argument comes up in a lot of different contexts, that the reason this is this kind of action is impermissible, or the reason that this kind of it doesn't need to be something like pornography. It can be something like this line of scientific inquiry, like doing research on stem cells or something. That somehow that threatens human dignity, and so that is a sufficient reason for regulating it. And I mean, you wrote a little bit about this recently, let's talk about it.
Right. So Yuval Levin's book that came out not too long ago tackles some of these issues at the end, where he laments the fact that conservatives, when they're being drawn into discussions and arguments about bioethics, find themselves having to make moral arguments that are based in what he calls moral sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
So a whole slate of activities that conservatives are inclined to think we shouldn't sort of drag out under the glare of argument end up getting dragged out anyway. things that he calls taboo,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I'm not sure if that's the word that I would use, but his basic argument is there are some things of which we simply don't speak without shame or delicacy in public. But alas, for conservatives, in order to defend their position on these sorts of issues at the intersection of politics and science, they have to participate in making these implicit or hidden or shameful or secret things explicit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, my concern is that if you
it's the problem you about these things, you have to look at the girly mag before you can say whether it's obscene or not.
Right. And not just judges, but, you know, mm-hmm. anyone who wants to engage in that kind of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, once you start poking around at the mysteries of human existence, then, in a way, the act of poking itself will disenchant the things about human life that we take to be sacred because they have this untouchable or mysterious or mystical character to them.
Mm-hmm. I wrote a long blog post quite a while ago, I think now, which was a response to something Steven Pinker, I think, had written in response to the President's Bioethics Commission headed by Leon Cass. And what it was, I forget what it was that Pinker was writing about. He was writing about our, you know, retributive impulses or something like that, and whether we should, like, listen to our sense of what people deserve in terms of criminal punishment. I shouldn't have brought it up. I forgot the context of it. But the Cass report, at which Human Dignity is in the title. I forget. Do you remember the name of that that report?
Oh gosh, one of our PomoCon bloggers, Peter Lawler, was on the Bioethics Council. I don't know if I remember the exact title.
There's something about Human Dignity.
There's the final report that they produced.
Yeah, and Cass is very closely associated with this idea of the wisdom of repugnance, and that there are some things that just offend our moral sensibility at such a level that we should treat these reactions that we have, that these sentiments that we have, as guiding us toward what the edges of what is natural and unnatural in some sort of normative sense of natural, that we're feeling the boundaries of what's permissible through sentiments like repugnance. We might not be able to articulate a principle that captures why we feel it in this case and not in that, but it's capturing something real. And part of that whole picture, as you were saying, is this idea that, like, that if we start digging too deep, we can end up sort of disenchanting the world. And this has been, you know, a worry for ever, I guess. You know, so the idea, Galileo had to be, punished because the idea that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe, that would throw everything off, right? Or Darwin was dangerous because the idea that human beings are just another animal, it's going to leave us with a disenchanted view of the world in which we won't be able to understand our places as human beings, and so on and so forth. Like all these, you know, and partly because partly because of that history, I was wondering, well, you know, we've gotten it wrong so many times, I think. So why aren't we getting it wrong this time? Right? Why should we care about what we happen to feel about stem cell research? Maybe this is just another sort of passing contingent, sort of socialized response in the same way that panic over the idea that the world wasn't and that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe is. What I wanted is, like, what we need is something like a theory of optimal disenchantment. And I don't think it shouldn't be impossible to give a theory of optimal disenchantment, that it might be true, that there are certain things, if we knew about them, that it would cause some kind of breakdown in our self-conception or our ability to live with one another in a decent way. And I don't think you can rule out that that isn't a possibility. But in order to figure out what the point of sort of, you know, maximum disenchantment is, you have to go beyond it, right? Because, you know, because the science that you're going to need, the conception of human nature that you're going to need in order to identify the optimal, you know, the point of optimal disenchantment is probably going to be an incredibly disenchanted notion of what a human being is, and it's going to be able to analyze in a fairly disenchanted way how people's beliefs relate to their self-conceptions and how their self-conceptions relate to their the meaningfulness of their lives and how all this relates to the ability of people to form decent communities. And that's my version of the kind of paradox, is that you have to go past the point of optimal disenchantment to identify where it is. And the people most worried about it.
Well, there's a question here about how risk-averse we should be or are, right? So there might be some optimality in saying, hey, rather than pushing the envelope until we know that we've crossed the line, maybe we can guess at, relative to where we've been, whether where we are is a place that's, you know, one or two steps removed from too far. So that way, maybe you don't have to cross the line if you're willing to accept accept a level of enchantment or disenchantment that is dialed back a bit from where the crossover point is.
Yeah. So why would you have any confidence that we would do a good job at identifying, so that our caution would be well advised?
Do we really need to know why murder is bad? Do we really need to murder someone in order to know why murder is bad, for example? Answer seems to be no.
I agree.
Okay, so then you sort of walk that back. And you say, do we really need to experimentally have incestuous relationships in order to try and figure out whether or not incest crosses the line? And I don't think that you need to test that moral question through direct experience in order to have some level of confidence about the decision not to go there.
Excellent example, because I disagree. I think part of the reason.
And I know you've done a little writing on incest yourself.
I think you linked to something that I put up a couple years ago or last year. Yeah, there was a case in Australia of a woman and her father, entering into a romantic relationship. When she was in her 30s and her father was in her 50s or something like that. And they just asked to be left alone. And I think I said that, well, so what's the problem?
Right.
And because this is, this is exactly the point. When I hear the account of it, I'm like, well, what's the big deal? I understand, and they understand, I'm sure, that there are hazards to any potential children that they might have, and that might be a reason to be especially cautious about that. But I don't know. It doesn't bother me. And so when we get to that point, when people do it, and some of us are like, gross, over the line, and some of us are like, if they like it and they're not hurting anybody, that's okay with me. How do we judge who's right in that kind of case?
Well, from one perspective, right, you could say that whether or not it's hurting anyone, whether or not it's gross, and whether or not we should just shrug instead of passing moral judgment are three separate issues. So it seems to me essential to say that there must be at least some activities that don't, quote unquote, harm others, which nonetheless carry some kind of moral opprobrium to them. Not necessarily ones that should be codified in law. I would expect that there would be some that would and some that wouldn't. But, you know, it's one thing to say there are some people out there in incestuous relationships that doesn't, I'm not going to do anything about it, but it's still horrible and we'd all be worse off if, you know, many more people partook of them.
But, again, I'm still not, I don't disagree with the, I obviously agree with the idea that there are things that are, you know, morally worthy of condemnation that shouldn't therefore be illegal. And there are lots of things that don't hurt anybody that are, you know, worthy of condemnation. But that shouldn't be illegal. But like this particular kind of case, so I, you know, that why is it that people judge something like incest to be impermissible? And it seems to be this, you know, what you know, a psychologist like John Haidt call, you know, a feeling of moralized disgust. And the question is whether a feeling of moralized disgust or a sense of repugnance has any, should have any epistemic standing, should count as evidence in favor of the idea that something is not to be done, or is worthy of opprobrium. And I think the evidence points to no, that this reaction. So there's a philosopher at Purdue. What's his name? Daniel Kelly, I think it is, who's been working on moralized disgust. And the, you know, the best going theory, that, as far as I can tell, is that the evolutionary origins of the disgust response were to keep us away from sort of bacteria and parasites. And that later on, this this disposition to feel this certain way was recruited by other systems to help reinforce certain kinds of social boundaries and to help sort of police social norms. But the best evidence we have about social norms is that they're highly contingent and variable from culture to culture. And that people in different cultures have different disgust responses. And so my attitude towards the disgust response was, well, if you can show me that response is part of, plays some role in reinforcing norms that are really instrumental to the function of a social system, then I'm going to give some weight to the disgust. It's actually playing a role in helping people get along with one another in a good way. But the fact that it exists doesn't give you that, right? It might just give you, just might be evidence that here's a place with, you know, backward social norms.
Well, I mean, one thing that we could try and emphasize is, you know, run down the list of things that most people find to be extremely repugnant. So cannibalism or voluntary amputation or incest, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask, why is it this class of things or this bucket of behaviors that goes into the abject disgust category so often? One answer might be not that it's random or that it's just sort of a normative backwater, but that these are all activities and behaviors that in some way undermine the foundations of what it is to be an individual person. And that, you know, you can hark to the line, the famous line in Roman Polanski's Chinatown, where John Huston says something along the lines of, oh, you know, to Jack Nicholson, most people don't realize that at the right time, in the right place, anyone, you know, people are capable of doing anything, anything at all, including, as the case was in the film, incest.
Mm-hmm.
If it's the case that, you know, things like cannibalism and incest and voluntary amputation or slavery or what have you undermine the foundations of what it is to have individual being, to be an individual person, then that might point us in the direction of an explanation for this kind of disgust. That when you find yourself in a situation where you're freely practicing incest and freely engaging in cannibalism and those sorts of things, our ability to maintain the integrity of our individual being starts to break down. We start to think, oh, I could be anyone. I suppose from a certain perspective, I am anyone. And when you start going down that kind of road, then you're eating away at the fibers of social order, at least in societies like ours.
That's really interesting. The question that I have is that I don't understand what it is about something like incest in particular, or you know, cannibalism, that threatens individual being any more than people transgressing or crossing the line of whatever their society's sort of deeply inculcated norms are. So I mean, maybe the social norm is that that around here, white people don't consort with black people, and I fall in love with a black woman, and we make love, and I realize if I'm able to do that, I could do anything, right? Like, all bets are off now. So how do you respond to that kind of response?
Well, I think that relies on the kind of slippery slope argument that when it comes from the right, gets laughed off, right? I mean, I think we know just from our own sort of civilizational experience that it's not it wasn't miscegenation that gave people that kind of horrific rush or confrontation with the primacy of possibility, but slavery was, right? And so race-based slavery might have intensified that experience. But I think that when you're looking for that kind of experience and you hark back to the way that slavery negatively impacted a social order, you will discover that, gosh, when I am able to do sort of whatever I want, whenever I want to another human being, it's not just their individual being that is being undermined by that relationship, but it's mine too.
So you were saying that people didn't have a sense of really strongly, like deep moralized disgust at the idea of miscegenation?
I'm suggesting that the scenario you painted where someone had an interracial relationship and said, oh no, if I can cross this boundary, then then suddenly it's not clear to me why any boundary is legitimate. That seems implausible to me. Whereas a relationship of slavery where race was involved actually seems like a very plausible example to me of a relationship which would cause someone to have the kind of experience that would undermine the integrity of their individual being and the plausibility of other kinds of boundary, normative boundaries that have been set up.
I thought that the problem with slavery wasn't that slaveholders had some sense that their individual being was threatened. I thought the problem was that their sense was that it was completely natural and there was nothing to question. And that was the problem, is the fact that people didn't in fact have some sense that there was anything deeply wrong, despite the fact that there was something deeply wrong. That nobody was getting many people never got reliable information from their intuitions about the legitimacy of treating another person as property. They felt fine with it. It seemed to them completely natural and proper. And their sense of the integrity of their individual person was strong. They were, this is what I do. I grow cotton and I've got slaves and this is who I am, and they, are a whole person, and they die a whole person, and never felt guilty a day.
Well, okay. So
do you think that that's not possible?
Yes, that's possible. The argument that I was, the case that I was referring to was not one in a sort of a boring or uneventful master-slave relationship,
mm-hmm.
But a kind of master-slave relationship which pushes the very boundaries of, pushes to extremes what it is to be a master and to be a slave. So although, I'm sure there were plenty of slaveholders who had a low level of interest in pushing into exploring the furthest reaches of a master-slave relationship, I'm sure also that at least some people who found themselves exploring the the extremities of a master-slave relationship, discovered through that exploration that the integrity of other sorts of boundaries that we associate with the integrity of individual being were beginning to break down. So, you know, again, there are certain, it seems to me there are certain, certain class of activities which, when you undertake, when you pursue them in a serious kind of way, or in an extreme kind of way, call into question the foundations of our individual being or character, and the sets of normative regimes that rely on it.
Okay, I think I got you. Now, so I guess the big question then is your position that sense of the integrity of individual being is that sense of personhood or identity, is that a kind of useful fiction that allows us to form certain kinds of social relations that are otherwise impossible, or is that some big deep fact about us that sort of is a metaphysical fact about people, that there are certain conditions for their for the integrity of their person, and the integrity of persons is so valuable that we need to be on guard against anything that threatens it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the question, and it's an important one. And my answer to it is that just because you can destroy something doesn't mean that it isn't real or isn't factual before it's destroyed. So I would say that, yes, you know, our integrity as individual beings is an important fact about who we are and what it is to be human. But as we well know from historical experience, we can destroy that fact about ourselves. This is to set aside for now, you know, questions about the soul and that sort of thing. But, you know, you look at things like concentration camps and you look at events like the Holocaust, and you, I think, are forced to conclude that that it is possible to damage individual human beings to such a profound extent that it becomes that it taxes our ability to recognize them as human. That's something that should cause us to become horrified and disgusted, not for some mystical or hard to explain reason, but because we begin to glimpse that we have the possibility to annihilate ourselves and to annihilate one another. That seems to me to be a source of disgust that isn't reliant upon mystery. Of course, it would be nice if we could, if we didn't need to even have a memory of the horror of things like mass murder in order to know that mass murder is bad. But that's why memory is good, because we can remember other people who transgressed other important norms in horrible ways, and retain the wisdom of the knowledge that transgression is as horrible as it is.
I remain a little bit perplexed, partly because my superficial take on something as terrible as the Holocaust is that, you know, the problem simply wasn't the self-annihilation of concentration camp guards. It's the fact that they were perfectly well intact and did it anyway. They didn't really hurt themselves. And that's why we need to be on guard, is that it doesn't necessarily, it's not contrary to human nature. It's not contrary to the conditions for stable personhood to do terrible things to other people. Which is why we can't count on those things to set the boundaries for what we can do. We need to figure out what the actual conditions are for a decent society, try to inculcate those values into people and sort of police those norms. I just don't think that the problem is that the personal identity of SS guards was dissolving.
Well, let me be clear that I was there are two problems. One, that, you know, that there are ways, and you can see this in some of the more torture porny movies that have come out lately. There are ways in which you can do such violence to a human being that they cease to be recognizably human. That's horrifying point number one.
Sure.
Horrifying point number two is that I think a thin description of what it means to be a functioning, intact human being would be the kind that you'd have to use to describe your various SS guards. But, you know, if you sort of read Rent or McIntyre, you see them saying, no, the kind of, the Eichmanns of the world or the SS guards of the world who were able to go through the motions of being human were, in fact, radically damaged in their humanity, and that it's impossible to think of them as not radically damaged in their humanity, and to think that any normal person is capable of doing this sort of thing. It might be the case that for a variety of reasons, someone who starts out fairly normal winds up becoming a monster, right? But at a certain point, don't you have to recognize that the becoming a monster period of their life has, in a way, come to an end, and the being a monster period of their life has begun?
Yeah, I guess I just think that people have the capacity for doing terrible things, and that's perfectly consistent with the conditions for psychological health. I mean, there's so many cases of genocide. Look at the Hutus and the Tutsis and the savagery involved in that. There's the sort of whole the record of how hunter gatherer societies will kill one another sort of wantonly. I don't think there's anything inhuman or especially strange about people doing incredibly cruel things to other people. And I don't think that there's something deep that you lose as a human being when you do one of those horrible things. That's why I think civilization, culture, and the enculturation of certain kinds of moral norms are so important, because you just can't, what is natural is often pretty nasty.
Well, I definitely agree there. I would say there are different varieties of cruelty, and that the sort of cruelty involved in tribal warfare can be distinguished from the kind of cruelty on display in, say, the TV show Dexter, right? And it seems to me to be just as stipulative to say, oh, you can be a serial killer and still be psychologically healthy, as it is, perhaps from your perspective, to say, no, it's impossible to be a serial killer and to be psychologically healthy. Right, so it doesn't. Mm-hmm. I don't see any reason why.
I think a lot of American special forces troops are probably serial killers who are psychologically healthy. People get trained to be serial killers all the time, and they go home and have babies and raise families. Some of them are wounded by it, and some of them aren't. It's scary to me that sometimes people aren't. I don't know. I don't think we're going to resolve this. Maybe this points us to the question of the continuing existence of the culture war. So you sent me an article. Tell me about why some people think the culture war might be over.
Well, a while back you had the Newsweek cover story about the end of Christian America, and around the same time, Focus on the Family's James Dobson, you might recall, came out and suggested basically that his side had lost the culture wars. What's the quote? Here it is. "We tried to defend the unborn child," he said, "the dignity of the family." There's that word, dignity, again.
Mm-hmm.
"But it was a holding action." He said, "We are awash in evil. The battle is still to be waged. But right now, we are right now in the most discouraging period of the culture wars." I'm slightly paraphrasing. "Humanly speaking," this is a direct quote, "we can say we have lost all those battles." There's another perspective, of course, mm-hmm. which says, well, no, Sarah Palin is still around, and there are a lot of people who are still not ready to just roll over and let the culture wars end. I think the more interesting position is one that says that the culture wars aren't over by a long shot, but they're probably changing in ways that neither side perhaps anticipated. I don't know what your baseline is as far as the general culture wars passé, not passé, over, not over question.
If it's defined against as the clash between like the Dobsonian evangelical right just these vague forces of social change, then in some sense it looks like the cards are pretty stacked against it. We're gonna get gay marriage all over the United States sooner or later, the pace of that change has been striking to a lot of people. Came to Iowa a lot sooner than I would have anticipated. And so I think a lot of those questions are just sort of being dealt with, that they're getting settled in a way that, that say, James Dobson disagrees with. But I'm sure that there are other senses of the culture wars in which they never, in which they can't ever possibly end. For instance, I feel like culture war is how things happen in a liberal society, that the idea that people should be arguing with one another and trying to persuade one another of things and trying to shift conventions and norms through cultural means, through oratory, through art, through just the pressure of ostracism. I think that that's perfectly healthy, and that's what we ought to continue to do. Of course, people have different ideas about which directions we should be going in. So I think it's inevitable that there are clashes among people with very different conceptions of what a decent society is. One thing that I find myself in conflict with, I think that there's a culture war between an incipient culture war between what I think of as the conservative left, or which I think of as a certain kind of communitarian environmentalist.
Sure. Social Democrats.
Yeah. No, I mean, I wouldn't say social Democrats. I mean, I think there's
Christian Democrats.
Yeah, there's a particular ideology. It might be people who are completely have no religion, but are very worried about the welfare of the planet, very worried about environmental issues, very worried about local issues versus global issues. I think that is in really stark conflict with the upshot of just the mainstream of liberalism in the broad sense. And so I think there's a culture war there. Of course, religious people haven't gone away. They have ideas about where the society ought to go to. So I think culture wars always have many fronts, and if one of them is closing, another one's opening up.
Well, I think that's right, and I would broadly endorse echo your position on the importance of cultural contestation, especially to the extent that we can carry it out without resorting to cultural politics in the way that maybe we've thought of it recently, where people have this, I think, fear that unless they codify their particular cultural convictions or commitments into law, then they are sure to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that everyone needs to. You can't reduce that risk to zero. I think we're all very poorly served by a sort of climate in which we begin to think that the only thing that you can put trust in, the only thing that you can rely on in terms of stability and durability for the way of life that, in your in your phrase, is decent, we're going to run into trouble, because then every war is going to become sort of a national war over the law of the land. And it's been that movement toward the Supreme Court as a final, yet not so final, arbiter of prevailing cultural norms that I think has been fairly destructive. There's got to be a swing back in the other direction toward the kind of kind of cultural contestation lower to the ground level that that you suggested. Another point that I'd make, mm-hmm. I think, is that the cultural contestation that you see taking place on the left is also taking place to some extent on the right, but it also, maybe even more interestingly, seems, at least to me, from sort of one foot in and one foot out, to be taking place or to be starting to take place among libertarians, where you've got some libertarians who are so appalled by what's been going on in terms of spending and federal power and centralization during the Obama administration, that they're quite unwilling to abandon that quest. Whereas there are other libertarians who are, I think, woefully inclined to say, oh, let's celebrate our ability to be, you know, to talk dirty on TV, and let's try to legalize pot, since that seems like that might happen, and we can be happy about gay marriage, and we can basically just go home. How seriously do you take that incipient divide?
Do you mean just like the different priorities of people who care more about economic liberty versus social liberty?
Well, I think it's starting to become more than a question of preferences or priorities. It seems as if some libertarians are increasingly willing to just to surrender the game on economic and perhaps even political liberty if they're able to carve out a satisfactorily broad sphere of private or cultural liberties.
I can't say that really describes a position that I'm familiar with. I mean, I do have a sense that different people have different interests, and so I've got, you know, friends who are in the marijuana legalization movement, and often there are people who care very much about economic liberty and see that issue as an issue about economic liberty more than an issue about just the freedom to put anything you want in your body. So I don't know. I mean, I see different splits. I mean, like I experience quite a bit a division between a certain kind of a cosmopolitan libertarianism that is not really particularly America-centric, and a certain kind of libertarianism that I would associate with somebody like Ron Paul, the libertarianism in one country sort of libertarians who see the United States as a kind of unique bastion of freedom that has to be protected, tend to be very patriotic, tend to have very strong views about limiting immigration and so forth. And I get in a lot of, a lot of conflicts with those people, and we'll both sides will consider themselves libertarian and think that the other side is, benighted in some way.
Well, and limiting the size and scope of government as well.
And limiting the size and scope of government, yeah. I really do think one of the big issues, I'm not sure how interested people are in sort of internal libertarian debates, I think there really is a big issue about America. Like, do you think that the United States is somehow special and is the and should have some place of priority in the activism of somebody who cares about the values of liberty? And I think it is and historically has been special, but the issue about the fate of the United States isn't question about the fate of liberty on Earth isn't the same thing as the fate of liberty in the United States. And I think some libertarians disagree with me that they don't really care about the fact that Canada or Australia or lots of Europe have become freer in terms that they would agree are freer over time. That's just they don't pay any attention to that. And I see that as a just kind of a lamentable kind of provincialism, that I care about liberty, and I care about it everywhere. The questions about the United States interest me especially because I live here and I'm part of this community, but I don't think that there's a huge amount, there's not, everything's not at stake when it comes to American politics?
Well, I think that I would encourage everyone to care, if they care little, to care much more about these kind of inter-libertarian controversies, because I do think that they're having increasing relevance outside of libertarian circles, and they're starting to influence or be resonant with debates and fissures that are taking place on the right and the left. A friend of mine's writing a dissertation on American exceptionalism and sort of competing visions of American exceptionalism. My suggestion was that one vision might be considerably more imperialist than the other. So you could be an American exceptionalist, and you could say, hooray, America, America first, let's, look homeward and not behave like an empire, but a republic. Or you could be an American exceptionalist who says more or less the reverse. Right. And as the right begins to struggle with that question in a protracted way, or a slightly more perhaps vulnerable way, and the left, I think, is beginning to encounter that kind of dilemma as well, especially with an eye toward what's going on in Afghanistan, and the varying levels of support that you get out of, say, a Hillary Clinton or a Michael Moore, or whoever. These kinds of questions about the uniqueness of America and how I don't want to say ethnocentric or parochial, but as you suggested, sort of how much we should care about America at the expense of or separate from the rest of the world. This is a question that's beginning to resonate, I think, more broadly across the political spectrum, because there's more than one way that you can care about America in isolation from or as distinct from the rest of the world. One of my favorite examples of how this resonates is the question of U.S.-China relations and what America needs to do, if anything, to as the buzz phrase goes, compete with China on the world stage. There's a school of thought that says that China is sure to eclipse us in a rapidly globalizing world for a number of reasons, but particularly, as a guy like Tom Friedman would put it, because they have the benefit of a one-party system, and they have this big pool of labor, and the one party can sort of organize things from the top down, and you can have this semi-planned economy, and it's basically a more efficient way of catapulting yourself into the catbird seat of the global economy than what we poor Americans have, which is, a Congress, messy democracy, right? There's this vision that's a disturbing vision, a growing vision, that politics is for stupid people. And that if you the smarter you get, the more that you realize that politics will only hamper your goals. But there it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Tom Friedman's just so dumb, I have almost... I don't know how to respond to it. I think this debate about... the idea that America needs to be number one is just completely toxic. And secondarily, like the issue that, like, is it, Tom Friedman, like, apparently missed the 20th century and missed the debate about, the possibility of democracies, doing better than centrally planned economies. And so it's just hard to know what to say about a guy who's that dense. But to the issue that we were talking about before, the idea that, If somebody does something first, that's some kind of dishonor to Americans. I think it's just ridiculous, and it's something the culture needs to get over, and it's something that's endemic in our politics across parties, that America must be the leader in the world in this or that or the other thing. If it's America's comparative advantage, then it will be the leader in the world. If it's not, we shouldn't be trying. It's simple. I wish my hope is that America at some point becomes more like Canada, you know, in just seeing itself as one nation among other nations, and trying to govern itself well, and not seeing every single issue that happens in the globe as somehow something that they have to take a stance on because we are sort of the global leader. I think it's terrible.
Well, yeah, I think that's a much more natural position for America to be in. It would be nice if we could figure out who or what sort of arrangement we're handing our global domination off to, but, you know, I'm inclined to agree that if we can get there in that way, it'll be to our benefit. The kind of thinking that troubles me particularly is, to return to the China example, people who say, you know, we need year-round education, because look at all these other countries that have year-round education, and if we don't sort of follow their lead, then we're going to get left behind in the globalization race.
Mm-hmm.
Or South Korea or Switzerland ranks five spaces higher than the United States on this list of industrialized nations. Therefore, we need to do whatever it is that I, policy wonk, already want us to do.
Mm-hmm.
When, of course, you know, there's no argument there. I mean, I'm sure there are lots of ways, lots of respects in which we would not at all want to be like South Korea, or in which it's totally ridiculous or inappropriate for us to try to imitate South Korea or Switzerland or whatever. But people drag out these, it's the industrialized nations beauty pageant contest line of argument. And they just slap it on whatever it is that they thought already is a good idea, and trying to chase the leaders in the industrialized nations ranking seems to me to be a terrible way to try and understand what works best for us.
I agree, and I think we've overrun our allotment of time. So cheers to a less exceptional America.
Hear, hear.
Thanks, James.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.